I view myself as a learner. And there are so many people in this room and upstairs this morning that are learned about issues related to hunger and poverty. I come to you with a basic belief that voice makes a difference. And the louder the voice and the more persistent the voice, the more influence voice can have. So I come to you from that perspective and like to share with you some of my experience. I wrote some remarks down because this is not an area of expertise for me, but an area I'm learning in. So if I could go through these remarks, perhaps later we can have some conversation about them. This room reminds me, I'm a retired school principal, and I can't tell you how many faculty meetings I've walked into where the first row was empty. overachievers typically sit in the first row, so you guys. as I understand it, this session, at least in part, is about how to facilitate change. And the reason I've been invited is because of my involvement in the Food Stamp Challenge, which we adopted primarily to influence the passage of the Farm Bill. That was our goal. And in fact, the Food Stamp Challenge that we participated in Nashville was one of about 40 such challenges a national organization I'm part of helped to organize. But before I tell you a little bit about the challenge, I just wanted to ground us in some facts of reality. Poverty in America has reached record heights, as all of you know. It's higher in this country than in most developing countries. Almost 40 million people in this country live below the official poverty line. Millions more struggle each month to pay basic pay for basic needs, including food. At present, about 11% of all adults in this country and 17% of all children live in households described as food insecure or hungry. Here in Nashville, as the mayor intimated, more than 70% of our children are on free or reduced lunch, is in the free or reduced lunch program. Even in Williamson County, we have schools approaching 40% who are on free or reduced lunch. We know the enormous costs of hunger on society. You know those. I don't need to review those. A little bit about the Farm Bill. As most of you know, I'm not sure where all of our knowledge level is. I may be the newest learner in the room. But I hope I'm not repeating to those who already know this, but the Farm Bill is, as many of you know, a very comprehensive, multi-layered piece of legislation. Most Americans do not understand that most of the nutrition acts that feed the poor, many of them are in the Farm Bill. We think of the Farm Bill is strictly subsidies to farmers. It's far broader than that. It should have been passed months and months ago. But unfortunately, earmarks from congressional members and other political difficulties and challenges have kept the Farm Bill from passing. The good news is that the allocation of dollars for nutrition markups has been assigned. It took a lot of work to get the House and the Senate to agree. They've gone to conference on it. They're still in conference. The issues at hand have more to do with the earmarks than they do with the nutrition pieces. What we're fairly confident of, and you can never be sure with the United States Congress, is that when this thing does pass, Nutrition Act will be subsidized at a reasonable level. At least we're confident of that. That being said, it has not yet been passed. And we're running out of time because its limitation is due in March. And we're not sure what level poverty programs will be funded if the Farm Bill is not passed. So given all of that, I'll tell you what my work is. I'm a member of a local group called the Community Relations Committee of the Jewish Federation. We are the public action, the public community voice of the Nashville Jewish Federation. We're called the CRC. There are about 150 CRCs around the country in virtually every major city and small cities. Our CRCs are part of a broader organization called the National JCPA, Jewish Council for Public Affairs. And that's our founding group. And they're located in New York headquarters, but we have lobbying offices and action offices in Washington. And we pass public policy resolutions on a number of things at the national level, and then encourage the field, such as our CRC in Nashville, to activate on them. Poverty, issues related to poverty and hunger, among many social issues, have stood out throughout the time I've been involved in this organization. I sit on the national board, but I chair the local board. And as a national board, I also chair a national committee on poverty, confronting poverty. And I can tell you that that committee addresses things through voice, through the purpose of changing public policy. And we approach things in a number of ways. Number one, we believe that the more educated people are, the better conclusions they'll reach about issues like poverty. So it's our job to help educate not only citizenry, but officials. The more educated public officials are, hopefully, the more likely they'll pass sound public policy. So we need to educate public officials. We believe that if you could eradicate hunger, you can start eradicating poverty. Hunger is the gateway to eradicating poverty. I'm going through this quick. We believe that eradicating hunger is doable, that in a short period of time, we can at least cut hunger in half. All we have to do is add $10 billion additional money to subsidize programs like food stamps and food and lunches for kids and food for daycares and food for hunger banks. We can just increase a trivial amount in our national $1 trillion budget, and we can cut hunger in half because we know these programs work. And lastly, we operate under the premise that addressing hunger is not an issue of charity. It is not an issue of charity, it's an issue of justice. Mm-hmm. And I refer you to this report that came out of the Center for American Progress Task Force on Poverty, because it outlines how we can cut hunger in half in a clear way in a short period of time. Moving forward, our organization has always believed that the loudest voice gets heard. So we speak loudly and frequently. We do that by educating ourselves first, then educating others. We do that by framing our voice in a way that people will listen to it. And we work hard at that. We do that by inspiring decision makers, by writing letters and going to visit them individually and calling on them and phone calls. We activate our large field monthly. We generate attention in the media by educating those who are writing stories in the media, and we ourselves never stop writing, each other and others. Our national committee, I won't go through that, but we're a very strong activist community. We have monthly call-ins to Congress. We educate ourselves through monthly experts who get on conference calls with us. Our conference calls that I chair are the most impossible thing I've ever done, because we could have 100 people on a conference call listening to an expert, and you're supposed to facilitate that. But it's energizing. But let me tell you about the Food Stamp Act, because that's what you specifically wanted me to talk about, the food stamp challenge. We've been criticized a bit for it, because some people who are opposed to expanding expenditures on nutrition activities looked at us and said that you guys are just playing rich people playing a poor person's game. And we accept that. That's a point of view, but that's not truly the case. What we use the food stamp challenge is three things: to educate the larger community, more importantly, to educate public policy makers, and number three, to activate our own field. And it worked for us. As I mentioned, we did the food stamp challenge here in Nashville, and there are other food stamp challenges popping up. I'm speaking to a church Wednesday night that wants to replicate what we did. First of all, the people who took our food stamp challenge will, to a person, tell you that this changed their lives and had a great deal of impact on how they look at people who are hungry. even though it was just a week. We had a debriefing after it was over, and the 50 of us that did this gathered in a room, and we were supposed to meet from 8 to 9, and we were still there by 11. I couldn't get people out of the room. There were tears. There was emotion. There were people. It was cathartic. People were remembering things in their own history about having been hungry themselves that they hadn't touched in many years. So for us, it was learning. We all committed ourselves that we would take the experience and share it with the whole world. And people in our group have done that. People that took the food stamp challenge were clergy leaders, several members of the city council. I think we had six or seven. Howard Gentry took it with us. Brady Banks from the mayor's office. The mayor was in his first month of work, and we didn't push him too hard to eat with us the way we were eating. We had many people of influence took it, and then people just like me who had no influence but just needed to learn. What did we learn? We learned that getting through 7 days living on $20 was not hard. Because for me, I could just buy pasta and be happy. I didn't lose a pound. I gained weight, as did others. But I could eat peanut butter and pasta and be happy the rest of my life and die 15 years earlier. So I could live on $21. But what we all realize, there is no meat and there are no fruits and vegetables on $21 a week. What we did is we all gathered at the Kroger in Bordeaux that caters to several people, many people on food stamps. We all gathered and we went shopping. Bob Mueller from Channel, what station is Bob Mueller on?
Two.
Bob Mueller took the stamp, the challenge with us, and he televised much of his activities, which was good for us. We all met and had some food stamp recipients walk us through Kroger. I didn't realize that people buy expired milk at half price, but our food stamp recipient walked up to the general manager of the Kroger and said, "What do you got in the back that you're tossing out?" He said, "I happen to have a couple cartons," and he sold it to her for 50 cents on the dollar. I didn't know you could pick up a piece of chicken in a package and hand it to the butcher and say, "I need a third of this because I can't afford the whole package." I guess my wife might have known that. I didn't know that. There were things that were going on, and that experience that just changed us. I walked around the store and found Howard Gentry in a corner crying because he's been helping a family and never went shopping with him but helped a family and for the first time felt that he experienced what the family he was helping experienced. So it changed us. At the same time we were doing this food stamp challenge, we embarked on an email, letter-writing, phone-calling campaign to our own congressional delegation and other congressional delegations around the country demanding passage of the Farm Bill Nutrition Acts, demanding that the Senate match the House markup, which was pretty substantial in the summer, but they were dattling on. So we pushed. I'm running out of time. I'm sorry. All right, let me get right back. Okay, let me just get back to my conclusion. I could go over this, the reason why we were pushing the Farm Bill, if any of you are interested. But I wanted to just end my thinking with the one reality we all knew is that at the end of the week, even though for some members it was really difficult, especially those who had kids and had families to take care of, we all knew that at the end of the week we were going to go back and eat the way we always did, but that anyone who was hungry was going to repeat that week and repeat it for the rest of a long time. I look differently when I walk into Maggiano's for food and I think about who's watching me walk in, because the thought of walking into Maggiano's is something they can never entertain. Never thought of it in those terms. So taking this food stamp challenge, as hokey as some others might have thought it was, has changed my outlook. But the point I was making is that because of the food stamp challenge around the country, we had congressmen take the challenge with us throughout the country. Jim Cooper took it with us when we did it here. And I'm happy to say that the voice that we expressed had an influence on the increasing dollars that were placed on Nutrition Acts and food stamp commodities and commodities for food banks. I'm pleased that we had an influence. And what I'm sharing with you is, don't ever underestimate the power of the public's voice in influencing policy.
And I think Meg is going to talk a little about that too. We work a lot with fair wages
and grassroots campaigns and dealing with fair wages. We're looking at this from a perspective of not just production, but distribution and access. And I think that's what we're trying to get to, is that how powerful public policy and the farm bill and things like that, and how these things support all of us in our daily lives, can do things to make changes and improve just by raising our voice. And they tell us a little bit about what she's done in living wage work.
Well, you have that up. And sure. I don't think I have enough for one for everyone, but it's just a scan. Hi, everyone. I'm really pleased to be here. My name is Megan Makara-Egg, and I am the director of Mid-Tennessee Jobs with Justice. We're a social and economic justice organization that builds strong coalitions among faith, labor, and community groups to come together to fight for justice for our most vulnerable people in this society. But before I get into that and talk with you about public policy and living wages and the link to food security, I'd like to tell you some stories about myself and some stories about people that I've worked with in the course of campaigns. Because I think that it's that sort of thing that reminds us of why we care and why we do the work we do. I know many of you are quite familiar with the Farm Bill, for example, and some of the economic policies that we need to get behind all of us at the federal and the state level as well in order to make the sweeping changes we need for working folks and for poor folks. But tell you a little bit about why I'm here. I am the oldest daughter of five children, and when my mother and father were divorced, our family went from being a very comfortably well-off middle-class family, my father brought home a doctor's salary, to being poor immediately. My mother couldn't get her child support payments in a timely manner, and we struggled to just have enough food to feed five children. I remember times when my mom would make a game of turning on the oven in the kitchen because she hadn't been able to pay the electric bill, and so the lights were out, and we were in sleeping bags in the big house that my father's income had been able to purchase, sleeping on sleeping bags being heated by the gas stove. I remember my mother going into the power company and the water company and negotiating about when and how and what percentage of the bills she could pay, and standing with her. And just, you know, the feeling of powerlessness as a child watching my valiant mother figure out how to make ends meet for our family. And to have gone so quickly from being so comfortable to being so uncomfortable and in such crisis brought me to the understanding at a young age, and I think all of you have a story like this for yourselves, and that's why you're here, that, you know, there's this notion that of grace, right? That there, but for the grace of God go I, you know? And I realized that the idea that we can pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps and that we deserve what we get and we get what we deserve is completely false. It came to me, like, suddenly, standing there with my mother as she was trying to negotiate one more week of having lights in the house for her five children. So I became a community organizer. You know, I tried to become an academic, and I have still a lot of heart for that work, but I became a community organizer. And the issues that always drew me were issues around economic justice for workers. There was a period, and I'm 39 now, there's a period in my life where I took a few years off because I became a single mother myself. And I was eligible for food stamps the entire time that I was a single mother of a 3- and a 4-year-old, and I never went to apply. Not once. Number one, I didn't know I was eligible. And number two, I was proud. I thought because I had a job, I didn't understand the public policy, right? So it sort of put a little bit of layer on my understanding of how we need to move social change. You know, I'd always thought that, you know, we have to do policy. I mean, there's so much service work, there's so much advocacy work going on. We have to just go out and do policy. But because I myself, a very well-educated person, didn't even know that I was eligible for food stamps and I was making the same sorts of decisions and struggles that my mother was, I realized in the course of that, that going out and educating both people who are eligible recipients and ourselves about public policy is supremely important because that's the basis on which we need to act. So, you know, I think it's interesting and ironic that I took a pause from my work on living wages to work for MANA, which is an organization that's been in Nashville and Davidson County for more than 25 years, working on these very issues of food security. And I became the food stamp outreach specialists and went out into the community. I went out into the community trying to make sure that people who are eligible for food stamps actually can be enrolled. And I'll tell you a story about that and then go on to living wages. Because for me, this story illustrates how it's all connected. My time at MANA and learning about the Farm Bill and learning on the ground about how many eligible families we have in this county and how many are actually not accessing their benefits really brought it home to me that all of this has to come together, that we can't just care about food security, that we can't just care about living wages, that we can't just care about health care, but they're really all connected. So I got a call about 3 weeks ago from a woman named Juana Orozco, and what she told me was that her husband had been driving on Christmas Day to work, and he was pulled over. Maybe he'd committed a moving violation, maybe not. People of clear Latino origin are being pulled over frequently by our local police now. He was pulled over. He was undocumented. He was put into a holding cell and then deported by INS because our local police are now collaborating with INS and deported about 3 weeks later. Her family was suddenly in a massive crisis. They couldn't pay the rent. She couldn't feed the children. I mean, massive crisis. And her children are citizens. And so she was struggling to negotiate being out essentially in the wilderness, you know, and how is she going to take care of these children? And luckily, she went to work for someone who said she could babysit under the table. She could have a place to live, but she still didn't have sufficient food for her children. The woman called me terrified, but really at the end of her hope, you know, trying to figure this out, terrified to go into the Department of Human Services because her husband had just been deported for driving, basically, to work on Christmas Day. And long and the short of it is that because she makes some small pittance for conducting childcare, but her employer is afraid and unwilling to give written documentation of paying her, she can't access food for those citizen children. That's where we're at, okay, in this country right now. That's where we're at. That's where public policies that are being enacted under our very noses are all overlapping with each other and amplifying each other to drive vulnerable people further and further into poverty, like Avi was talking with you about. It's stunning to me. I received a call from an organization named HOPE that were helping families after the INS raids on the Electrolux factory in Springfield. And whatever we think about that situation, right? The impact on those families, and what they said was actually quite literally 1,600 people fled the city of St. Springfield. It was much more than the press had actually reported, as it usually is, right? The community knows actually what's going on. 1,600 people had fled. Those families, many with citizen children, could no longer access rent by the end of the month, food, anything, left with no infrastructure for their lives. And I asked myself, as I figured out how to help them hook up to Feed America First and get some food distributed to them through the Catholic Church that they were working with in Springfield, I asked myself, how is this any different, what's happening here in Tennessee, than what happened with Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans? with an entire community completely devastated, homeless and hungry, going on under our very noses. So it was ironic when I came out of organizing retirement to be with my children as I transitioned into being a single mother and getting divorced that I should be pulled back into organizing through the Vanderbilt Living Wage campaign. And the story that really got me again was, some of you have seen this article passed around, was the story of Mary Hampton, who was a single mother, a housekeeper at Vanderbilt, making less than $8 an hour, who became homeless when her husband left and moved back to Africa. She went to live at Safe Haven Family Shelter. Now, it was ironic to me because I knew that Vanderbilt is the second largest private employer in the state after what? FedEx in Memphis. So without FedEx, and Memphis is a national distribution hub, Vanderbilt would be the largest public employer in our state, employing over 20,000 people, with a chancellor making at that time more than $1 million. But people coming who basically are the wheels of that university, the cogs that make it run and make it the beautiful place that it is every day, becoming homeless on a salary of less than $8 an hour. And I realized, as a person of conscience, that number one, this didn't happen because the decision makers at Vanderbilt didn't know better. They knew, right? The organizer told me that it wasn't that. It wasn't a lack of education. The students had done a great job educating. In fact, they'd gone in and to a board of trust meeting and done lots and lots of really good education about living wages and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da and how this could come out of the budget and all that. They'd done their homework. It was about a lack of political will. And this is just one example. And so we built the moral and political will in the community. We slowly but surely built it in order to support these workers. At the end of that particular struggle, we realized that it's really not enough to be working with one institution, right? And it's not really Vanderbilt University that's the problem. It's a very broad systemic issue that in this country, the minimum wage doesn't even come close to a living wage, a family supporting income. And until that's the case, we can do all we want to try to fix the symptoms of the problem, but we will never get to the root of the problem. So I'm part of a new organization now that's working on bringing together across broad sectors in the faith community, amongst unions, in the community at large, and amongst the people, the working people who make our city run, the taxi cab drivers, the folks who work at the temp agencies who can't go get a job anywhere else, the people who even work for our city who make less than a living wage, to really try to figure out how we can bring together the moral conscience of our city to say, no, this is not acceptable, right? And until we do that, until we come together to do that, things won't change. People like Mary Hampton will continue to experience what they experience. So, thank you.
I want to wake you all up. You're sitting in chairs, and all that is very exciting. I know that probably it's comfortable, way too comfortable for this panel. But we're here for cultivating an agenda for change. And like I said, this is a very big topic. It was quite impressive to me to even start to think about it. We could do a whole session on the farm bill, and it could take all day. And we really didn't even touch on it. I wanted to use local examples of, and I think you're seeing array. I mean, one common thread is education. One common thread is getting involved in voices. I think if the question becomes, you know, we have a whole parameter from hunger and just bare necessity of access to food issues, which are affected by policy and public policy, to nutritional food in schools, which is a different situation. It's not just feeding children, it's feeding them more healthy foods and local foods, and it's a whole parameter, and they're all impacted by policy. I'd like to just start any kind of conversation on things that you've heard that resonate with you, or some example things that you have worked on or interests that you have, and currently, right now there's current legislation, which is an example of policy change. Steve Hodges, the Jubilee Project in East Tennessee, has worked very hard to put together farm to school legislation. Now, who knows what will happen with it, but it will give a geographic preference to local foods. 35 states across the country already have this in place. Now, why we're not there yet, that's something we should be talking about. And what we're here today for the Food Security Partners is, as an organization, as different partners, can we we all bring something to the table. What should we be doing? Where should we be going? What are the problems, which are many, and how do we address them through policy and policy change, whether it be social, economic, tax policy, those sorts of things. Does anyone have anything? Questions?
I've got two things. I didn't think about this until you started talking about the schools. I work at a school. I'm a recycling environmental activist for the last 18 years. I also work at Granbury Elementary School. That's where I head up a recycling program. I have a constant battle with the school system because of the styrofoam trays. There's been information put out that it's dangerous to microwave our food on these trays, and yet the students are served food. Students are served food on these polystyrene trays, and the food's very hot, and you can see where it's melted the tray. Mm-hmm. And food service's basic policy is it's cheaper to buy styrofoam trays than it is to hire someone to run the dishwashers. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can do two things here at the same time. We have brand new schools with brand new dishwashers that are not being used because food service is looking at the bottom line. They're counting pennies with the polystyrene trays, and I think they're introducing chemicals into our children's bodies. Mm-hmm. Also, I've come because it came to my attention a couple years ago, talk about policy. In 1992, I don't know if you all knew this, and I heard on NPR when they were talking about food security partnership, I thought this is a great place to find people that would be interested in this. In 1992, we finally banned the dumping of sewer sludge into the oceans because of concerns to the water and marine life, and it was at that time that the EPA not only began sanctioning but promoting the land application of sewer sludge. And currently, more than half of the sludge that is generated in sewer sludge, of course, is this material that is a result of wastewater treatment facilities treating our water, trying to purify. So the material sludge is literally the toxins that they're pulling out. And they are now, over half of the sludge in this country is being land applied. So you talk about local food, you've got to worry about the quality of food too. This is our orange groves in Florida to the almond groves in California and everywhere in between. And currently the city of Nashville has a $117 million wastewater treatment facility that was supposed to come online last fall. They're in the middle of an RFP looking for people to either take this stuff for free or to sell it to them for land applications. Now, if you put this on a golf course or if you put it in on crops, you're introducing it into the life cycle, into the biocycle, and this is very, very dangerous. There's groups that have been around. In fact, I have a handout if anybody's interested in this. One of them was titled, this was 1997, it was the National Sludge Alliance. Is it toxic sludge or cow manure that is contaminating our food supply? And of course, everyone I'm sure is aware of all the supposedly E. coli-laced spinach that was contaminated by cow manure. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much truthfulness. I think the current administration maybe has opened many of our eyes to maybe the how truthful government is and what really is going on under our nose. It's interesting that prior to 1992, in the 10 years prior to 1992, there were only 15 reported deaths from E. coli. Since 1992, when they started the beneficial land application of sludge, there are anywhere from 200 to 250 deaths every year from E. coli. So I would hope that other people would be interested in this topic and contact. It was interesting to see, and I know Mayor Carl Dean has inherited a lot of this stuff, but when he's talking about sustainability, I do not want to see our city going in the direction of land applying its sludge. This stuff needs to be going into the landfills until we can figure out a more safe way of dealing with it. Thank you all.
I think it's important. I mean, one thing that I've come across, and I think we can all speak to this, is economics drives. A lot of the times, and unfortunately, one of the things we're coming to from a policy perspective, like I am approaching my current job and also my work with Food Security Partners, is we're doing a Building Your Local Economy Task Force with Food Security Partners. We'll be doing that in the next 2 years, and it will be taking a food shed. Like, I'm taking the temperature of where we are in Middle Tennessee and figuring out, you know, where are we, and where are we going? We have to know where we are, where does our food come from, and what are the economics? So we can talk to those people who make those decisions and make the arguments that, yes, you have dishwashers, you should use them. You know, I think farm to hospital and farm to school, Diane can talk a lot about, you know, the barriers that she comes up against, and a lot of it is economic based. It's not that you don't want to do it, it's that it in their mind, it costs less to do it this way than it does to do it that way.
Well, they're not looking at the larger picture.
And that's a policy issue that we have to address.
On these styrofoam trays.
Yeah.
Can any of you speak to just your experiences in trying to affect any kind of policy change within city, county government, state government, or whatever, that's unwilling to listen to any of these kind of arguments?
Diane?
Being from Memphis, where we do not have a mayor that is progressive, I guess is the word. I'm probably the only person, I'm sure, from here from Memphis. This falls on deaf ears. It falls on belligerently deaf ears.
Mm-hmm.
Gaining traction for any of these kind of issues, going and talking about hunger, unless you're with an ecumenical ministry or with a particular program, is not going to be responded to. We've had an immense amount of difficulty in trying to even get people to listen.
Well, from a school standpoint, in working with our school system, just keep talking. And any issues,
I
guess that I've...
We don't even have a school superintendent, so the mayor, Memphis mayor, may not
we
have
don't either.
To take over the school board
and
run the school board. We've been over a year without a superintendent of the city school.
I'll give you a one person's response. It's not an educated response. It's a personal response. I find most political people of influence in the political world, when you are conversing with them one-on-one or in small groups, are far more empathic to issues than when they are sitting in registering their public voice. So I never get turned off by that public voice that seems to be difficult to get through. It's persistence, it's willing to go in and talk with them, it's talking to their chiefs of staff, not even them. I do believe that the more we work at talking to those who are making policy decisions face to face, that we have an opportunity to change how their worldview is.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems frustrating, but I could tell you countless times, example here, not even to do with poverty. We've had awful immigration public policy presented to our city council.
Mm-hmm.
The whole city council, looking at the electorate, was going to support it. But when we approached people individually and had individual conversations, and we shared with them information that they didn't have access to, their public decisions changed based on what we did privately. So I can only tell you, don't lose faith. There are human beings that need information like the rest of us, and we know a lot more than many of them do. So share what you know with them. I'm not discouraged. I'm optimistic that we can make our voice heard.
Yeah. Community organizing is it's a scientific thing in a way. There are things that if you do, you will increase the possibility of winning what you want to win, right? And so I would say, number one, that you sit down with someone who has had some experience moving a piece of public policy through whatever decision-making body that you're concerned about moving a piece of public policy through. You sit down with them and come up with a year-long strategic plan. And then you work that through with various champions or allies that you identify in that body that can help you understand that body, that can help you break down that big body, right? Like, say we're talking about our Nashville council is basically a legislature. I mean, we have 40 council members, you know.
Council members in the city of Chicago.
You have to lobby a legislature, right? So I came to Nashville to work for a group called Stand for Children, which is the grassroots organizing arm of the Children's Defense Fund. And we were working with childcare providers who wanted to pass a piece of public policy that had a budgetary impact. Right, they were going to be doing a relatively small ask of $200,000 to help support childcare providers in a facility here, for example, at Westminster. Excellent childcare. We worked with Westminster on this. So we're talking with really active, involved citizens. But you know, you look at the council, and it seems like how are we gonna break this apart? Well, we thought about the committees, the committee structure that we needed to look at. We looked at Budget and Finance Committee. We found two allies, Eileen Behan. Remember that when Eileen was on the council? That was great. Eileen Behan and David Briley. And they taught us about council. And then we went, and because we were organizers, we knew how to train our folks. We taught our folks about council. We taught our folks about how to think strategically about council. That Budget and Finance at that point would vote as a block. They wouldn't vote separately. So that we really, and when Budget and Finance voted, they could go out and get the rest of the votes in council around things that they particularly cared about. So that we really didn't even have to get half of 40, that we had to go and get a certain section of Budget and Finance. Now, we didn't know this, right? But our champions knew this, and they, because they cared about our issues, and we had those individual visits that Avi's talking about, where we had people who are directly affected by the issues tell their stories, they helped us figure out how to strategically influence council, right? And little by little, we taught our members about, you know, a whip list, which is, you know, you figure out who are your allies, who's on the fence, and who's the opposition, and then you figure out where you need to put pressure, political pressure. And you're typically not going to pressure the opposition if they're far away from you, or you're very strong allies. You're going to go to the middle. And so we taught, you know, it's an art form, and it's very scientific around how you're going to move a piece of legislation through a body of decision makers.
It's also finding, I think, unusual partners. I mean,
exactly.
Beyond your, like, for me, recently, I did a lot of 2 years of food farming. I'm working with farmers markets, working just, I really am a farmer groupie. So, I mean, unabashed and unapologetic. I don't farm, I have no interest in it, but I love to go to farms, and I love to eat all the food they bring me. and I don't have shoes because I buy too much food. And but it became an environmental issue for me, and I met up with some environmental, and started getting involved with Tennessee Environmental Council, and said, wait, oh my God, you guys have been around for 20-something years. You don't have a food and farming section? You guys don't address farming issues? It's land. It's water. It's air. It's everything to do with environment. These are partnerships that weren't being made.
Mm-hmm.
And it's finding, you know, those groups of people who maybe, you know, the Farm Bureau, maybe we don't agree on everything, but we can agree to disagree on some things. And
right.
They're powerful. Let's get together and let's talk about these issues, because this is why it matters to you.
Right.
And that's been, I think, where you build that network of people that are like-minded, and you build this network of, okay, we don't all agree, but let's figure out what we can agree on, and then let's move forward to change grassroots and top-down, meaning the top-down approach and the bottom-up approach. You know, go blast Memphis, come to the state. Let's work with the state of Tennessee to see what kind of pressure, you know, the state government could put on
mm-hmm.
those situations. So, I mean, even if the state doesn't control school lunch, I mean, that's made by a local decision-making body. But the state comes down with a decision that says, at least a voice that says, we want to open up our schools to local foods that are proven healthy and have been treated a certain way. Then the metro goes, okay, well, it's kind of, you know, word from high that we're supposed to try to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are some options that I've seen. Did that help at all with your question?
Well,
it really is. And I've talked to your wife a little about that.
We run into a certain number of challenges that I don't think are experienced in Nashville. And,
you really deal with the county and the city. You have Memphis County.
Yeah,
Memphis.
They
county
do.
And city, and, you know, my own personal conversations with everybody from our revenue to Farm Bureau or whatever. You know, it's like that place that's off the edge of Columbus.
It's near Arkansas. It's our previous Arkansas.
Right.
That's, you know, occupied by sea serpents.
There's a particular. There's Reverend Rebecca Jordan in Memphis with Mid-South Interfaith Living
yes,
Justice
right. yeah.
Network. You know, they passed a living wage ordinance in the city and the county. It took them 3 years. So they learned a lot of lessons about those particular bodies.
Trying to influence your suggestion about learning the ways to break up the city council members, those kind of things are all very valid. We have people that connections and community, those kind of folks who have, you know, determined that we can break it up into all of the individual city council members and still not give our opinion to go. So, you know, our best chance is to support people within the county who are going to step up into leadership roles
right.
and support them.
longer-term strategy?
Well, a lot of things that I wanted to mention have been covered in different ways, and it's coming back to this theme of sort of interconnectedness of all of these different issues. And I'll just touch on a couple of them. I'm from Chattanooga, and a few years ago is when I moved to Chattanooga from the Atlanta area, and I'd heard about farm-to-school programs and said about, okay, Hamilton County, here we go, farm-to-school. And it was like a brick wall, you know, bureaucracy, obstacles, it can't possibly happen. Mm-hmm. Here's the litany of reasons why it can't possibly happen. And, you know, you just keep talking. You know, I was involved in some community volunteer organizations, and any chance I got to anyone I could talk to about farm to school, and everyone just thought it was the greatest idea, except the people who would have to implement it, which was the Hamilton County Nutrition folks. And, you know, they're not bad people. They have legitimate reasons why it's a daunting thing. You can't just go overnight from styrofoam trays to a functioning kitchen. But there are a lot of those things that can be overcome. We know it can be. And I've started working with Cleveland, which is just up the road from Chattanooga in Bradley County. Cleveland City Schools is a much smaller school system. They have a little bit more flexibility. They don't have as many meals to prepare. So they were more willing to take it on and say, okay, maybe for our small amount of lunches compared to how many Hamilton County has to serve, we can make it happen. So the other thing I would mention is the Farm Bill. I work for the Land Trust for Tennessee and in the Chattanooga office, and there's a provision in the Farm Bill that will enhance, well, the tax benefits for farmers who put their farms in the conservation easement were enhanced to for 2006 and 2007. Mind you, these people are giving up millions of dollars probably if they were to sell off their farm for subdivision. So any little bit we can give back to them, and most farmers are land rich and cash poor. It's not like they're going to get rich off doing a conservation easement. If anything, they're, you know, they're giving up a lot. So there's a provision in the Farm Bill to make permanent the enhanced tax benefit for farmers who put their farms under easement. And it's so important to keep working farms, especially in areas that are on the edge of development. Middle Tennessee, the Chattanooga area is growing. If we're going to have a sustainable local food supply, we've got to have the land to grow the food. So I would encourage you, along with the gentleman who's also encouraging people to you know, talk to your congressman or whatever you need to do to say, hey, pass that farm bill, because there are, in addition to the very important nutritional supplements, that's another piece of the food security puzzle, is the enhanced tax benefit for farmers.
And if you want to learn more about that, we have actually a little expert here on the farm bill if you have any specific questions.
Oh my gosh.
But I have, you can contact me. I have a list from the Southern SOG Convention conference about a couple of weeks ago. We actually had a whole panel on farm bill. It was just an introduction panel, and to be honest, I had no idea half the stuff that's in the farm bill. I should have, but I just had no idea. So I have those handouts. I can get them to you, and it's also got an action list put together by the Food Security Coalition that says, here are the big provisions that are important that need to be acted on, and here are your congresspeople to talk to, and here's who you should be calling. Yeah. So those are things that are really, as policy goes right now, the biggest deal.
That's, like, so important, because I was unaware of this until I, like, started researching the Farm Bill, but if they don't pass it by March when the 2002 one runs out, it goes back to, like, the permanent law of 1949 or something like that. Like, really, 1949? This is 2008. Like, I think that's so important to mention, too, is, like, we have ability to communicate and, like, with these congressional leaders. Like, it might seem like you don't have a lot of voice, but, like, I think that's so important what they've been saying about you do have a voice, and you can express your voice and take advantage of that.
Joel?
Yeah, I would simply echo that. My name is Joel Morton. I've worked for Farm Aid, Willie Nelson, for our support organization, and just kind of echo what people are saying about Farm Bill and how important it is now for all of us, wherever you happen to be from, contact your congresspeople and urge them on to pass the Farm Bill before March.
I can tell you Lincoln Davis was actually out of the country, or he would have been here and been one of our panelists. He's on the Ag Committee, and I was specifically going to put him in this panel on the seat so he'd have to answer this question. Discuss the Farm Bill.
You had some on this, right?
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I really appreciate the three panelists and everything y'all have been talking about. I just want to share resources kind of relevant to this topic. The book called A New Weave of Power, People and Politics, The Action Guide for Advocacy and Citizen Participation. Some of y'all probably use this. This is pretty new to me, but just having read through it and kind of delved into it in a workshop this past fall, it really just seems very grassroots, citizen-oriented, and practical. And you know, if you're interested in learning more about the title or you know, where to find it, just give me a holler after the session.
John Sherman, I appreciate all three of you because you all talked about either the whole picture about kind of the big systems piece or pieces of it, and I know way too much about the Farm Bill. And
well, if I'd known, you'd been up here too.
We all have lots of scars from all those different conversations, but I think if we just, this food census is a lot bigger than the Farm Bill, but the Farm Bill is, I think, important really to look at
as just
one view of it, because it captures and reflects kind of this whole thing about producers, the folks who are actually growing the food,
mm-hmm.
Which are not just the big corn and soybean farmers that you hear about all the time that are getting all the money. There are lots of folks who aren't benefiting from the commodity system that if they don't get a fair price, like Paul Bala upstairs, all these local farmers, they're not benefiting from that. And if we're talking about rural poverty, if you talk to Paul and her and his wife Robin, say, so what's your income from the year with your two kids? It ain't much. So one, I think that when we're thinking about the system, thinking about those producers, or thinking about all the migrant workers who are picking the avocados and the oranges and everything that we all want as fresh fruits for our kids and ourselves, but you know, there are kids picking that in California and in Florida. And so I think one, we have to think about that in terms of both fair wages, but also then when you turn and say, we want cheap food so we can have, so our kids can get more of it in our schools. Well, there's this tension between cheap food and how are we going to take care of the producers, the meat packers, all the people that are also participating in the system that may not be getting any benefit from growing cheap food. So I think when we're thinking about this system, because then they have to want food stamps, or they have to go get WIC, or they have to go get something else, which is an appropriate social response, but we have to think about the whole thing,
right,
and not just the pieces.
Well, I think it's coming back to the economic, and I honestly have no background in tax, and I just happened into my job, and I love my job now, because I work on the policy, but the economic side of it, and I think that's where we have to reframe as a country and as a state how we look at prosperity, what is progress, and
mm-hmm.
how do we put a value on living life, and really economically do the math and start looking at these things, because that's really, I mean, for me, I think it's empowering to people, and my one policy thing to say is, you know, like you said, touching a person, making it real to that person. I have a friend who was homophobic, very homophobic, and all of a sudden he met a girl at work and he found out that she was gay and had a partner and they had a daughter they had adopted, and now they're like, they have families hang out together, and it's a whole different thing. To him, it's different than the issue of, you know, gay marriage, and then all of a sudden it became real, and it's about making those real, concrete,
mm-hmm.
one person at a time, you know, one story at a time, and reframing the way people around you think about it. And it can be done. It's just going to have to take a little bit more time. So
we had one person
yes.
in the back that couldn't get their question.
I just wanted to say, I remember a former journalist, and I think that this issue sometimes gets complicated and maybe it's hard to introduce to the media, but generally,
and I think that's really
that's right.
true. It's the facts. I mean, when I do talk to people, it's really those little facts, like our average American farmer is, what, 58 years old now? We lost 1 million acres of farmland in the last
mm-hmm.
10 years, and where every year we lose so many acres of farmland. And it's about now with corn ethanol and, you know, corn prices, I got to say, I'm not really sad about that, because if you have to feed your cows grass, it makes me happy.
But to
know,
follow through
now
on
we're
that point,
land.
That's a strategy we also employ. One of our strategies is to meet face-to-face with reporters and editors, and when they refuse to write, to ask them if we could write our own editorials and our own pieces, if they won't.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. but we prefer that they will because it gets put in a better strategic place. But if I could add one last thing about public voice, in a conversation with Jim Cooper's staff, a gentleman, a young man who worked for the scene that's now his domestic point person, he said that most congressmen do the same thing that Jim does, that they have their staff log the emails.
That's
if,
right.
And they sometimes read them. They actually read our emails.
Yeah.
But if they don't, their staff has to give them a log for the day or for the week with the general content of the emails. And John reminded me that the calls against the Farm Bill were 10 to 12 against, and those of us supporting the Farm Bill were in the far minority. So when we ask what we can do, I have the luxury of living on a fat cat principles retirement. I don't have to work. So I get to do this all day long. But when I was working, I'd come home every day and write one or two emails or one or two letters. And if we all did that, our voice would be heard more. When you look at that darn Tennessean and you look at the people that respond to the articles, it's filled with people with hate. And they never hear our, we don't add to that voice. So I just think we can be heard more than we let
and
ourselves
and celebrate
hear.
Small victories.
Right.
I don't think we do that enough either.
We have an opportunity in Nashville to make a huge difference right now in how much local food we produce for Middle Tennessee, specifically for Nashville. You may have read in the paper on Monday about the Bell's Bend issue and how they'd like to put a new Cool Springs in Bell's Bend. The people of Bell's Bend, the people who live there, over 95% do not want that to happen. In fact, what they do want to happen is they want to preserve the rural character by turning the entire area into a farming community where they would produce local food for Nashville and Middle Tennessee. This requires partnering and making contacts with state senators, representatives, our councilmen, and changing a lot of the practices of the Zoning Planning Commission, because our state is not currently set up to plan to save farmland. None of our laws help our farmers save farmland. None of our practices in the Zoning Commission plan for saving farmland. So our farmland's disappearing at record rates. We have an opportunity here. So if you could all, if you're interested in this issue, if you could all call your local state representative and senator, call the Planning Commission. They have a special website on it, on their website, a special page. And even call the mayor and the governor and let him know that you want Bell's Bend preserved for the production of local food. They even want to put a sustainable farming institute there. This would produce food for the schools, produce food for the people in Nashville, train new farmers. Our biggest problem in Middle Tennessee is not that we don't have the demand for local food. All we've heard this morning is about demand. We don't have the farmers. If tomorrow they instituted a farm-to-school program and they decided to feed all the people in need, we wouldn't have the food to do it.
Mm.
So as we push for changes in these issues, we also have to simultaneously, in parallel, push for ways of preserving farmland and creating more farmers to farm that farmland. So we have an opportunity now. Go ahead.
Just to affirm any of the things that have been said and maybe identify some consensus points, the affirmation of the interconnectedness of the problems and the interconnectedness of the solutions, I think, is crucial. And helping people to see, if you're concerned about issues of water, if you're concerned about soil, if you're concerned about air, all of these are connected to economic systems that feed upon literally the exploitation of labor, the degradation of the environment. So to help people see all of the interconnected problems and the source in an economic way of life that feeds upon those problems, brings them about. I mean, economics, yes, specifically corporate influences. I mean, those who are writing our farm bills and our free trade agreements are the Syngentas, the Monsantos, the Cargills. And so, yes, you know, small local voices can be heard, but when you've got billion-dollar corporate interests who are writing the legislation, writing our policy, we need to start thinking about how do you confront that? How can we begin to to really tackle that. And I mean, historically, that's always been, you know, it's the formation of alternative economic relationships. So, you know, the things that this conference is starting to envision about local living economies, I think is crucial so that folks can begin to tap into on a very everyday, kind of mundane, the way I eat is bringing about social change through all these interconnected ways. I think
I love that Michael Pollan quote, which is every day you vote. When you walk into a grocery store, you take a chance to vote with your dollars. It's about that choice to eat, and what you eat is a political statement.
Yeah.
I just would like to throw out a word that I think is the answer to a lot of the problems, and it wouldn't make any sense, but it's organic. And I have not heard that word mentioned in this workshop. But for instance, if you support organic agriculture, you know, it takes care of what you're talking about. All the degradation of conventional agriculture actually degrades the land. You know, if you really want to bring value into your county, you find a way to support your organic organic farmers and organic agriculture. It's better for the soil, it's better for the air and the birds and your own water. Talk about food security and bringing food 2,000 miles. Well, why are we going to bring chemicals 2,000 miles to Nashville to kill our streams? Now, right now is the time we should be supporting, finding a ways to support people converting to organic agriculture, because if there did come a time when we couldn't bring in these chemicals, we've got an agriculture that's chemically dependent.
And I think the word wasn't brought up because with the USDA certified organic, we get into some weird places, and I agree. And I think transitioning to organic it's a harder.
There are places in the country that have actually found ways to solve problems. For instance, in Iowa, they give in one county they give 5 years.
I've read all the papers on that. I mean, and we're that's the thing in Tennessee, a transition. That's a question right now that the Farm Bureau is even asking, is if my farmers want to transition, how can they economically do it? It's a question of land use and how do we move it, and it's something that's definitely on the policy range. David, you had a question. And then we have lunch.
It was great to hear somebody mention sort of the corporate influence on political policy. Just wanted to bring attention to sort of the new movement set up mainly by a group called Democracy Unlimited from Old County, California.
Say this, what Unlimited?
Democracy Unlimited, and you can look them up at DUHC.org. They set new ordinances in Humboldt County that states that no corporation that's not granted a charter in that county can donate money to any political campaign whatsoever. And it just seems more and more that sort of the individual voice is being gagged by the corporate voice, which has been granted, you know, First Amendment rights, 14th Amendment rights, which was not granted in the beginning of the founding of this nation whatsoever. It's just been through, you know, Supreme Court hearings after Supreme Court hearings that's let corporations gain more power than the people who
are
supposed to be serving.
The corporations are made up of people, and that's one thing that a lot of times we forget is that the monolithic corporation, which I agree with, is that we have to start touching people who run these corporations. You have to start touching people who work for these corporations. Because they're people. It's made up of people who make policy, who govern what their corporations do.
Right.
And part of it is our policy makers who actually let the corporations, right?
But there is the
policy.
Dollar vote. We have your
yeah.
dollar
right.
vote, too,
and
what you buy.
Yeah, exactly.
Secondly, I mean, you know, they might have the same amount, sort of on paper, they might have the same amount of power, but one, they have a lot more money, they have a lot more lawyers, they can be anywhere at any time. These people don't die, right? They're always there.
One sentence does not
so
die.
Well, the corporation doesn't. It's
yeah.
legally a person.
Right.
Which is,
right.
Which,
well, it can't be.
They were originally supposed to be set up to serve the interest of the people in that state. They were originally set up to build bridges. They weren't originally there to pay lobbyists to act out in every facet of her life. They were originally there to be set up to do a certain specific job, and then they were dissolved, and their assets were split up amongst the people who were involved in
well,
the spirit of the conversation, at the end of our debriefing with the 50 people in a room, we had a choice, and that was to leave the room and just do what we said we would do, spread the word of our experience, or to take another step. And we had in the room, Jim was in the room, and his staff, Corker's people were there, Alexander's people were there, and we agreed to take another step. And so we're doing a summit, and a hunger summit for Nashville only. But we're bringing the corporate piece together with the advocate piece, mm-hmm. because that's where the money is. And what our premise is that we need to figure out how to take those wonderful donor dollars in this town and redirect them such that we can at least make an impact on the issues that we're faced with in Nashville. It's going to be an interesting dialogue because the chamber is signed on, and the mayor is signed on, and others of influence have signed on. It's going to lend to some conversations that you're, in a very small way, that you're speaking to, and I think we're going to learn a lot from it.
Well, thank you everybody for coming. Enjoy lunch and have fun.
Please give me a call. I have our national conference next week. So,